For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're going to be looking at Luke chapter 11, verse 37, and then we're going to carry that on into 12, actually verse 3. I entitled this section, A Dangerous Contagion. As you'll see, it makes sort of sense as we start studying the passage, but Jesus here starts to confront the religious leaders for their hypocrisy. And he warns that if we allow this hypocrisy to spread throughout our spiritual community, they can have devastating results, not only for us and the authenticity that we can have in a spiritual community, but also that it can actually turn people away from God. Let's begin in Luke 12, verse 1. Meanwhile, while many thousands of the crowd had gathered so that they were trampling on one another, Jesus began to speak, first of all, to his disciples. He said, "Be on guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." Of course, Jesus is using an analogy here. He describes the Pharisees' hypocrisy as a type of yeast that spreads. And if you know anything about yeast, even just a little bit of it introduced into a lump of dough will spread. And what happens is a yeast will enter into a lump and it will actually consume the simple sugars, and it will continue to replicate, and the entire lump, within really a matter of hours, will be filled with this yeast. And in fact, what it does is it releases alcohol and carbon dioxide, which is the reason why bread rises. And so he describes this hypocrisy as a yeast that can just completely spread through an entire community. Leon Morris, a New Testament scholar, describes it this way. He says, "Leaven speaks of a penetration that is slow, insidious, and constant." Sounds scary. Well, anyway, he says that this yeast is like a hypocrisy. And I think today, you know, we think of hypocrisy and there are a lot of different facets to hypocrisy. But the type of hypocrisy that I think Jesus is referring to is religious hypocrisy that the Pharisees and the experts of the religious law were guilty of. So we want to answer this central question: what is religious hypocrisy? And in order to do that, we want to turn back to Luke chapter 11 and listen to what Jesus says when he denounces the religious leaders of his day. Let's go back to Luke 11, starting in verse 37 and 38. As he spoke, a Pharisee invited Jesus to have a meal with him. So he went in and took his place at the table. Apparently, this Pharisee was impressed with Jesus and what he was saying, so he wanted to hear more and decided to invite him to come and have lunch with him. The Pharisee was astonished when he saw that Jesus did not first wash his hands before the meal. That word astonished actually is a little bit stronger than our connotation of astonished. It actually means insulted. So he was insulted that Jesus didn't first wash his hands. Now, the Pharisee wasn't worried about foodborne illnesses or bacteria. In fact, they were pretty ignorant about that back in the ancient world. He was more concerned about becoming ceremonially defiled. In the Old Testament law, there were a number of different restrictions for food and things that if you touched it or actually ate those things, they would render you ceremonially unclean. That meant that you weren't able to worship in the temple. And so, over time, the rabbis actually taught and interpreted the law so that they started to actually believe that this sin that would cause you to be ceremonially unclean could actually get transmitted by touching someone or by touching food and then eventually, you know, somebody else eating it. And so they started to view this as sort of like a disease that would spread, or a bacteria. But the Lord said to him, "Now, you Pharisees, you guys clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness. You fools! Didn't the one who made the outside make the inside as well? But give from your heart to those in need, and then everything will be clean for you." So Jesus strikes back at this Pharisee and he says, "You guys are fools!" He says, you know, you guys clean the outside of the cup, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness. In Matthew's version, which is a little bit, has a little bit more detail than this, in Matthew 23, verse 24 through 26, Jesus says, "You blind guides who strain out the gnat and swallow the camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they're full of robbery and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup of the dish, so that the outside of it may also become clean." So Jesus uses a little bit of humor here. He's like, you know, you guys are just like sitting there with your glass of water, and you know, a gnat flies in there, and so you're, you know, fastidiously trying to pull that out of your water, and meanwhile, as you go to gulp down your water, you swallow a camel. How crazy is that? He says, you guys are hypocrites. He says, what you need to do is you need to first clean the inside of the cup and the dish, and then it'll be clean. So they actually would practice this. Where they would clean the outside of the cup and the dish. Whenever the Pharisees would walk through the marketplace, they would have a little cup or a dish that they would carry food in, either food that they were selling or something that they bought. And they actually believed superstitiously that if you walk through the air of a sinner or a Gentile who they regarded to be ceremonially unclean, that somehow the air that they passed through, if it contacted your dish, would actually make your dish unclean. And so what they would do is they would go home, they'd actually scrub the outside of the dish, thinking that if they cleaned the outside of it, then they wouldn't actually ingest the evil that these other people had. And so they had this very superstitious view of things. And Jesus points out, he says, you know, if it were that easy, then we wouldn't have any problems. If it was all a matter of just cleaning the outside of a dish or scrubbing something, then we would all be pretty good. It'd be pretty easy to try to fix our problems. But he points out, it's not that easy. The problem isn't external. The problem is internal. That sin isn't something that you contract from other people or the evil world that's encroaching upon you. Evil is actually in the heart of each and every human being. He says, but give from your heart to those who are in need, and then everything will be clean for you. Luke's giving us a more condensed version. Essentially, he's saying, once you clean the inside of the cup and then express through your actions, what's inside of your heart by giving to the poor, then you'll be clean throughout, both inside and out. And so he points out that the root issue is our heart, and that what God wants to deal with is not the external. He doesn't want to just try to scrub the outside, but he wants to change us from the inside out. He goes on in verse 42, he says, "Woe to you Pharisees!" He says, "You give a tenth of your mint, rue, and every herb that you have, and yet you neglect justice and love for God. You should have done these things without neglecting the others." Apparently, they were so intense about this Old Testament law about tithing that they would go to their little planter boxes with herbs, and they would tediously count every single leaf on the herb plant, multiply it by 10%, and then pull off however many leaves were required for a tenth. And then they would give that. And Jesus is just like, you guys, you know, you're really missing it. You're getting caught up in all of these small details, but really you're neglecting what he calls in Matthew 23, verse 23, the weightier portions of the law. According to the Bible, all sin is equal in the sense that it renders us guilty before God. But not all sin is equally damaging. So what Jesus is pointing out here is that although it's good to give 10% of all you have to God, even down to counting, you know, what 10% of your herb plants would be, he says, don't forget the weightier portions of the law, such as justice and love. That the Old Testament law actually emphasizes certain things over others. And so what they were doing is they were so caught up in these minute details of the law, trying to execute them, that they were actually missing these bigger things. You know, in other accounts, we're told that Jesus critiques the Pharisees for throwing out widows out on the street because they're demanding their money back, essentially impoverishing these women. And so these guys who were so concerned about these minor points of the law would actually, you know, take advantage of widows and people who are oppressed. And so I think this leads to really the first thing that you see with religious hypocrites. Religious hypocrites tend to camouflage large moral failure with outward acts of righteousness. It's very typical. I remember an example of this that came to mind. A number of years ago, we went on this retreat with our home church, and this woman who came from another church background decided that she wanted to come with us. She was really interested in our group. And so we were there at this retreat place, and a number of newer people showed up, non-Christian people. And they brought their beer and stuff, and you know, they were hanging out with us and having a few drinks. Well, after the retreat, she calls me up and she said, I just have some really grave concerns that I want to talk to you about. And I said, okay. She said, well, you know, I noticed that some of your underage people were drinking at that retreat we went to. And I was like, well, okay. You have to understand, some of these people are visitors, like, they're not even Christians, and we don't feel right telling them, look, you can't stay here if you're going to drink and be, you know, as an underage person. And we certainly don't feel comfortable confiscating their beer that they brought with them. We feel like we should invite them in as guests and try to, you know, talk to them about spiritual things. You know, I assured her that we weren't buying them alcohol, and we weren't letting them jump into their car if they were drunk, but that was not satisfying to her at all. She was furious. And she was calling a number of people in our home church complaining about this and saying, well, I don't understand why you guys are so soft on underage drinking. Well, a couple weeks go by, and a woman who was trying to invest in her started talking to her like, you know, what's going on in your life? And of course, you know, she brought that thing up again. And once they got past that, she's like, you know, how do you feel like you're doing spiritually and stuff? And she's like, oh, you know, I think I'm doing okay. And she said, so I noticed that, you know, you've been dating your boyfriend for a number of years now. Like, how's that going? And she started getting real defensive, like, I don't understand why you're bringing that up. And so as she kind of probed a little bit more, she's like, so I know, you know, it seems pretty hard, I think, to kind of hold the line physically when you've been dating somebody that long. Like, how do you think you've been doing with that? And she just bursts into tears. She's like, I've been sleeping with my boyfriend, I just can't stop. And you're just like, whoa, so you were getting all up in arms about this underage drinker, and you know, it became clear that the underage drinking thing was completely a ruse. Where, you know, she was focusing on that smaller thing, because she was trying to camouflage this bigger area in her life that she knew was a problem. And that's really, I think, the way religious hypocrites operate, is that they try to nitpick other people and smaller things in their life because they know they got this bigger problem. He goes on in verse 43, again he says, "Woe to you Pharisees, you love the best seats in the synagogues and elaborate greetings in the marketplaces." Again, Matthew adds a little bit more detail on what Jesus said. In verse 5 through 7 he says, "But they do all of their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen their tassels of their garments. They love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats at the synagogues." You may not know what a phylactery is. It's a little leather box. And they would place pieces of vellum, which is cowhide, that they would scribe, you know, parts of the law in there. And they would put inside of that leather box and tie it around their arm and one around their head. Now these guys had the bright idea that they wanted to make sure to demonstrate their holiness to everyone that they had bigger phylacteries. So they would actually have bigger boxes than everyone else and bigger tassels. Clearly this is something that guys came up with, right? They're always trying to show that they got something that's bigger and better than everyone else. And you can just imagine they're walking through the synagogue and they're looking at these guys like, "God, look how small his box is. My box is way bigger than that, you know?" And he says, "You know, you guys, you love the best seats in the synagogues and elaborate greetings in the marketplaces." They would rush to the seats of honor because they wanted to get the respect from all the people. And so Jesus points out their hypocrisy. You know, with religious hypocrites, they seek to display their holiness in order to gain people's respect and admiration. They're always trying to show how they're better than people, always talking about the good works that they do, how they don't struggle with things like everyone else. And it's because they want to try to curry this respect. They want to try to manage their image before people. Verse 44, he says, "Woe to you, you are like unmarked graves," and people walk over them without realizing it. In the Old Testament law, we're told that if you touched a dead body, that would render you ceremonially unclean. And so the problem that people ran into in the ancient world is that they would actually bury their relatives in these unmarked graves. So as, you know, an unwitting traveler, you don't know whether or not you are actually becoming ceremonially defiled by walking over a grave. And Jesus points out, you guys, you religious hypocrites are just like that. You're like an unmarked grave, where when people walk over a unmarked grave, they become ceremonially unclean and defiled. But when people walk in your ways, following your example, they become morally defiled. Now, one of the experts in the religious law answered him and said, "Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us too. Don't you realize we're standing right here?" Now, a little bit of explanation on these experts in the religious law. These guys were trained experts in the Old Testament law. They studied the fine points of the law and interpreted how people could follow that law in various situations. And so they actually filled up numerous volumes of the Mishnah, which is these extra-biblical writings from rabbis, that detail different situations you might run into where you might violate the Old Testament law and what you should do in that case. And so it was a case law that they put out. Now, these experts in religious law were typically Pharisees, but not all Pharisees were experts in the religious law. But apparently, Jesus kind of made them angry too. He said, "Woe to you experts in the religious law as well! You load people down with burdens too difficult to bear, yet you yourselves refuse to touch the burdens with even one of your fingers." Goes after them. You know, when you read the Bible, most people think, oh, Jesus is this, you know, nice guy. He's super gentle. You always think of him like holding a little lamb. You know, he's got a little wispy beard, and he's just, you know, he seems weak. He seems gentle. And yet, you read some of this, and you think, wow, Jesus definitely was a prophet, and that he spoke against the religious establishment. He accused the experts of the religious law by loading people down with burdens that were too difficult to bear. Of course, he's not speaking literally of burdens that they were carrying around. Instead, he was saying, you guys teach that people, if they want to get in there with God, they want to be right with God, they need to follow the entire Old Testament law. Which, if you count how many laws are in the Old Testament, it's about 600 Old Testament laws. In addition to that, the experts of the religious law would say, you also have to follow the Mishnah, which we wrote. And so, that, if you want to get in there with God, if you want to be right with him, then just do all of that. And yet, the Bible expressly contradicts this. The Bible teaches that there's really no way for us to work our way to God. Think about what James says in James 2:10. He says, whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles at even just one point is guilty of breaking it all. Now, that doesn't really make much sense to us because, you know, in our legislative system, laws don't really interlock or connect with one another. They're typically independent. But when it comes to the Old Testament law, God gave the Old Testament law as sort of a dim reflection of his perfect moral character. So when we violate the Old Testament law, we're not just violating some principle. We're actually violating God himself, that we're offending him. Let's use an example maybe that would help us out. You know, a jigsaw puzzle. You know, the purpose of a jigsaw puzzle is to take the individual, unique, interlocking pieces and put them all together to form a picture. A number of years ago, my buddies got into jigsaw puzzles, and they bought this 18,000-piece jigsaw puzzle that was a panorama of the Sistine Chapel. It was about 10 feet by 5 feet. And they devoted an entire room in their house to this puzzle. Now you can imagine they were serious about guarding every single piece in that puzzle. Because, you know, let's say you got to the end of this puzzle and you realized that you were missing just one piece. I mean, that would be tragic, wouldn't it? Because even though you assembled, you know, 17,999 pieces and put them all together, if you're missing just one piece, you fail to finish the puzzle. And so likewise, we may be pretty good, we may do a lot of things right, but according to God, even if you fail at just one point, you violated me. That you've offended me, that you violated the law. And luckily, God says that even though we all stand guilty before God because of our moral wrongdoing, because we have violated his perfect moral character, God in his love and mercy sent his own son Jesus to come and die so that we could be forgiven. And the good news that the Bible tells us is that we can be forgiven free of charge by simply turning to Christ and asking for that forgiveness that he paid for on the cross. And so, Jesus was of course critical because they were teaching something that was ultimately leading toward destruction, that you could earn your way to God. Yet he points out, you yourselves, you refuse to touch the burdens with even one of your fingers. So these guys, even though they were saying, you need to do this, you need to follow the Old Testament law perfectly, they themselves were doing just the opposite of that. They were violating it. And really, that's the definition of hypocrisy, where you say one thing and you do the other. I think people in our culture today are pretty confused about what hypocrisy means. I remember riding with a friend, and we were on the highway just chatting. And he was a guy that I was, you know, talking to about spiritual things. And as we were driving, this middle-aged woman going 85 miles an hour cuts us off, and we nearly, you know, careen into the embankment or whatever. And of course, some off-color words came out of my mouth. And I don't know if you know this, but middle-aged women, I don't know what it is about that demographic, but they're dangerous on the road. I didn't know if you knew this, but your mom is the most dangerous person you know. Anyway, so my buddy, as I'm sitting there, you know, driving and sort of fuming still, he's like, "Oh, that's very Christian-like of you to say that." And the subtext was, you know, Christians don't do things wrong. And I pointed out to him, I said, "I don't understand what you mean by that." And he's like, "Well, aren't you supposed to be like a follower of Jesus?" And I was like, "Yeah." And I said, "You know, just because I'm a Christian doesn't mean I don't ever have any failings or any problems. The only difference between me and you is that I look to God in order to receive forgiveness for them." You know, when you think about Christianity, Christians aren't people who don't sin anymore. In fact, just the opposite of that. When Christians sin, they don't break the law, they illustrate what it says. They illustrate what God says, which is that there's nothing that we can do based on our good works or achieve or earn our righteousness before God, but it's only by what Jesus has done. And so, religious hypocrites, you know, they are guilty of portraying a level of righteousness that they themselves have not attained, either by explicitly stating that or by simply withholding information that might lead people to believe or see that they have problems. You know, Romans 2:1, Paul says, and really I think points the gun at these religious hypocrites. He says, "Therefore, you have no excuse, every one of you passes judgment, for in that which you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things." Now, Paul's not saying that you're a hypocrite if you say that somebody's wrong. He's not advocating for moral relativism here. He's simply saying these guys who claim to be perfect or righteous because of their good works, they're being dishonest because they're doing the very thing that they're judging another person for. In verse 47 and 48, Jesus goes on, he says, "Woe to you, you build the tombs of the prophets whom your ancestors killed. So you testify that you approve of the deeds of your ancestors because they killed the prophets and you build their tombs." Jesus is reminding them, remember the prophets of the Old Testament? They were denouncing your ancestors for their idol worship and their rebellion against God. And by you building these splendid tombs for them, you're just simply finishing the job. It's really easy to honor a dead prophet than a living one. And so what Jesus is pointing out here is that, you know, if you were alive back in their day, you would have done the same exact thing. In fact, we'll see later on in this gospel that their religious thinking, their hypocrisy would eventually drive them to kill Jesus himself. Then in verse 49 through 51, he says, "For this reason also the wisdom of God says, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and persecute, so that this generation may be held accountable for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah." So he mentions Abel, the first person to get killed in the Bible. And in Genesis chapter 4, verse 10, we're told that the blood of Abel cries out for justice. And so Abel, according to Jesus, was one of the first prophets in that his death cries out for justice and proclaims his innocence. And Zechariah was the last of the Old Testament prophets. And so essentially Jesus is saying is that you guys have killed all of God's prophets. Anytime someone spoke for God, you opposed them, you persecuted them, and that you will be held guilty for their blood. Okay, you might be thinking to yourself, this seems pretty harsh. Now, why did Jesus reserve the harshest words for these religious hypocrites? I think the first thing is that hypocrisy may actually block people from coming to God. The message of Christ is offensive. You know, when somebody in our culture hears that Jesus is the only way and that the Bible contains the truth, it makes people angry. Because it implies everybody else is wrong. Isn't that really arrogant to think that Christians have it right? Or to suggest that Jesus is really the only path to forgiveness and the only path to God. People are offended by that. Or when you hear something like, God only provides forgiveness through a free handout. That is his forgiveness in Jesus Christ. It really offends people. It grates against people's pride. And I think the natural tendency when you hear something like that is to try to discredit the message. You know, either by trying to pick the Bible apart, to try to show that there are contradictions in it. In some cases, people look to Jesus' followers and point out, look at the hypocrites that follow Jesus. Why would I ever follow him? You know, recently I heard this interview that was conducted a number of years ago down on campus, and they're asking people, what do you think of when you hear the word hypocrite? And of course, there were a variety of different answers. Most people were saying, well, you know, a hypocrite is someone who says something and then does the other. That was the standard answer that they were giving. But some people were furious. They were like, oh, hypocrites? They're like, I have no use for those people. They talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. And you could tell that they were angry about the hypocrites that they had met in their lives, referring to Christians. Others, of course, were a little bit more attuned to their own problems. They're like, well, hypocrisy, I don't know. I'm probably sure I'm guilty of that too. I've probably done something that I've judged somebody for. But I think that when you look at most people in our culture and ask them, what do you think about Christians? Most of them, I think, would view the Christians that they know as hypocrites. George Barna, in Lifeway Research Group, did a study of about 1,400 adults in 2007. 72% of the adult respondents who don't attend church thought that the church is full of hypocrites. So most people that they polled thought that Christians were hypocrites. 78% of those same people that they interviewed said that they would be willing to listen to someone who wanted to share their beliefs about Christianity. So ironically, they're interested in Christianity, but they're just turned off by Christianity's followers. And so I think the cost of hypocrisy is that people will start to view Christians as hypocrites and completely discredit the message of Christ. I think, secondly, hypocrisy can infect, spread, and eventually destroy an entire spiritual community. You know, first of all, it robs a community of honesty and authenticity. You know, I've heard of meetings where people will get together, like a men's group, and they'll be like, you know, I just want to confess that I've got this serious problem in my life. And I just feel so guilty about it. The other day I was on the highway and I was driving 5 miles per hour over the speed limit. You know, I heard of another case where a Christian confessed, you know, I realized that there was this stamp on an envelope that was unmarked, and so I decided to steam it off and to reuse it on another envelope. And the Lord just convicted my heart that I was stealing from him. I just think about sitting in that meeting as a brand new Christian or as somebody who was a non-Christian, I'd be thinking to myself, I'm just completely out of place here. These guys must have it all together. You know, they've fixed the major problems in their life at this point. They're just polishing the scuffs out of their life. Meanwhile, you know, I'm sitting there and, I got high last week. I struggle with drinking, and it's like, I don't belong here. And so when you have a community that is steeped in hypocrisy, people are going to feel out of place, people with real problems. Secondly, I think spiritual growth becomes difficult. You know, people are more focused on trying to impress one another, trying to manage their own image before the people around them, that they're not focused on where they're at with God. And so spiritual growth becomes really hard. I think hypocrisy erodes our ability to have deep relationships. You know, when you're always putting up a front trying to act like you're something that you're really not, then closeness in relationship becomes difficult, if not impossible. Because you don't feel like you could just open up and be yourself and talk to people about what's really going on in your life. In addition to that, it creates an environment of competition where people are trying to one-up each other in terms of good works. When you hear somebody talk about how they did this really good thing, it sort of prods you to want to point out that you did something really good too. And so it can create this environment where everybody is looking at each other and trying to size themselves up to the people around them to see which one is more holy or which one is more righteous. You know, in a group like this, God may actually withdraw his power to work through that specific community because he knows that those people are living a complete sham, that the stuff that they're confessing is really just the tip of the iceberg, that there are real problems underneath and that they're trying to pretend like they're something that they aren't. Now, I think this raises the question, is hypocrisy really a problem that others have or is it a problem that I have? I have a few diagnostic questions to maybe see whether or not this is a problem that we actually have in our lives. Have you ever felt bad that someone else got more recognition than you? That might point to the fact that you're guilty of hypocrisy. Because what does it matter whether someone else gets more recognition than you? Doesn't that suggest that you're comparing yourself to other people? That you're competing with them? What about this one? Have you ever held back the full extent of personal sin in order to seem more spiritual than you really are? Ever? Oh, let's expand on this. Do you withhold your problems so that you're portraying that you're actually a lot better than you really are to the people around you? And that's hypocrisy. What about this? Have you ever been defensive when confronted with personal failure? Why would you get angry? I mean, if God gives you assurance that he's forgiven you through what Jesus has done, then why does it matter what people think? It's probably because you want to try to put forward this image of yourself that's not real, that you're actually better than you are. What about this? Do you ever find yourself doing spiritual things to offset some sort of moral failure in your life? A way to camouflage the real problems that exist? What about this one? Do you find yourself comparing your moral goodness to others? Sizing yourself up, competing with other people? That's probably an indication that hypocrisy is not something that other people have a problem with, but something that you have a problem with. Something that I know I have a problem with. So how do we counter our own hypocrisy? Jesus gives us some suggestions in verse 2 and 3 of chapter 12. He says, nothing is hidden that will not be revealed, and nothing is secret that will not be made known. So then whatever you have said in the dark will be heard in the light, and what you've whispered in private rooms will be proclaimed from the housetops. Oh, think about that. Everything you've ever done, every thought, boy, I'm not looking forward to that day. That's going to be pretty scary for me. You know how it is when you're a little kid, you're sort of calculating, can I get away with this so that my parents will never find out? And if you know that there's a high probability that your parents are going to find out, it usually blocks you from doing that. Now, you're not going to get anything past God. There's no way. He knows everything. And he's going to tell everybody about it too. So we might as well just come right out with it and let people know what's really going on with us. So yeah, I think that, you know, there's going to be a day when all of that's going to be revealed. And thank God for his grace. I'm sure that that's going to mean a lot more to us when that happens. Now, let's think about what a community looks like that's free from hypocrisy. I think, first of all, people feel like they belong. You know, when I first came around, I had a lot of problems. I had a lot of baggage, things that I had done to myself that, even to this day, I'm still paying for. And I just remember getting around these guys who were really good guys. And I was ashamed of all the things that I had done, and finally I started to open up about it. And I remember, you know how it is when you finally decide you want to open up about this problem that you have in your life, you sort of wince because you don't know what's going to come next. And instead of experiencing judgment, you know, these guys showed me a lot of compassion and sympathy. And I came to find out that they struggled with the very things that I was struggling with. And so I felt like, you know, I'm not the only one who struggles with this. And so when we have an environment, a community that's free of hypocrisy, people feel like they belong. They don't have to try to pretend that they're something that they're not in order to be a part of what's going on here. Secondly, trust is forged within a community that knows each other. When you can let your guard down and be vulnerable about your problems and know that you're not going to get rejected, there is a level of trust that you could build with people, and you don't feel like you're in a community of people who, just sort of pass each other by or pretend like they're really close, but there's real deep friendship. Thirdly, I think people sense authenticity. You know, people who come and visit sense that there's something different about our community. It's one of the real attractive things, I think, that people talk about when they come and visit us. You know, I don't know what's going on with you guys, but I just sense that there's something different, that you guys are real, that I could be myself. Fourth, you'll see that people will focus more on God and not on man, not on people and what they think. And so it's not about who says this thing or this person, but instead it's all focused on God and what he says. And finally, I think God's Spirit powerfully moves through a group and changes lives through that group. You'll see that when a group is authentic, when people are honest about their failings, you'll see God work powerfully through that group, and typically, many people will come to Christ as a result of being around those people. Yeah, we pray, God, as a community, that we would never lose touch with your grace. I pray that we would root out hypocrisy in our lives, and that we would be vigilant to make sure that we're not becoming a group that is permeated by hypocrisy. I pray that we would always be a community where people, visitors, can come here and feel like they can, they feel accepted, where they can hear about your message and learn about your truth without being judged. And ultimately, God, I just pray that you would show us areas of our lives where we are being hypocritical, where maybe we are trying to present something to people that's not real. And if that's the case, I pray that we would just be honest and vulnerable, trusting that no matter how people respond, even though I'm certain that people will show us compassion and sympathy, that no matter how they respond, we would trust that we can look to you and what you say about us and be confident that we can just open up about our problems. And we thank you that we have that luxury in Christ. Thank you for that in his name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.